From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on this morning's Forum program, in his new book, Strange Tools, philosopher and cognitive scientist Alvin Noe posits an original theory of art and its value in our lives. He'll join us to discuss the ephemeral nature of how we perceive and understand art, and we'll also talk with him about the limitations of the contemporary trend of studying art through the lens of science or neuroaesthetics. Forum is up ahead. That's right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Alvin Noe joins us for this morning's second Forum hour. He's professor of philosophy at UC Berkeley and a member of the Institute for Cognitive and Brain Sciences and the Institute for New Media. He's also a regular contributor to NPR's science and culture blog, 13.7, Cosmos and Culture, writes about everything imaginable, including diesel engines, for example. And he's the author of a number of books which take on different topics, including Out of Our Heads, Varieties of Presence, and most recently, Strange Tools, Art and Human Nature. And we welcome Alvin Noe back to the Forum program.
It's a great pleasure to be back here.
Yeah, glad to have you back here. And you're taking up very small questions here. How do we know what art is? Why does it affect us? Why does it matter? I mean, what you're really going after here, which is even bigger than all that, is what can it tell us about ourselves or the human condition? Take on all this because?
Well, these days it's very much the fashion, I guess you could say, to turn to neuroscience for an answer to these questions. What is art? Why does it matter so much? What does the fact that it matters so much tell us about ourselves? But I've been struck again and again that instead of thinking of art as a sort of phenomenon that we want to explain, art can actually be our guide. Art is actually its own mode of investigation or mode of inquiry. And one of the questions that I look at in this book is, what is art teaching us, or what kind of an investigation is art? And one of the ideas I've come upon is that art is in a profound sense philosophical, and like philosophy, it aims at unveiling ourselves to ourselves, but doing so in a way that actually gives us resources for changing.
And thus the word tools. I mean, you see art really as, or works of art, as tools to understanding ourselves or our natures.
That's not quite right. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I use the word strange tools, but in a way, one of the things which is interesting about, if you think about regular tools, whether you're thinking of a hammer or email or any of the kinds of tools and technologies, is tools organize our lives. And they only do so because of the way they're embedded in the whole setting of our lives, the whole background. They're bound up with habits and what in the book I call modes of organization or organized activities. And one of the interesting things about works of art is it makes things that for all the world look like tools. They look like instruments that have an application, you know, pictorial representations which are comparable to what you might find in an online catalog. And yet we're not interested in them when we're interested in them as art, because they're effective in the way that tools and technologies are. So one of the thoughts I have is that, well, what works of art are, they're tools that have been made strange, and in having been made strange, actually bring out something about the way in which tools and tool-using practices and technologies make us what we are.
Neuroscience is not useful here. I mean, that's essentially what you're saying, isn't it? It doesn't necessarily get us to the, not only to the mystery of a work of art, but to how it affects us and why it affects us.
The problem, I mean, neuroscience is very important because the brain is a necessary precondition of all human experience, of all human knowledge, of all human engagement. But I think you'll look in vain in the writings of neuroscientists for insights into what makes the experience or engagement with art distinctive from all the other kinds of experience that we have. And I think fundamentally that's because neuroscience You know, and I want to be careful here. I don't want to I hate the fact that I've sort of positioned myself as somebody who's saying no to neuroscience, because I think of neuroscience as a field itself of investigation, and I want to be open to what discoveries it might make. But too often I think neuroscientists tend to think of experience as something that's triggered inside of us, whereas I think of experiences as temporally extended patterns of involvement with the world which we achieve and which we can fail to achieve. And so, I mean, take the experience of art. For me, the experience of art should not be thought of as something which is triggered in us when we look at an artwork. A better comparison would be, think of a dinner. Think of a dinner with a friend. It takes a whole evening, and it's shaped by your friendship. It's shaped by your conversation. It's shaped by the quality of the food. It's shaped by your interest in the food, whether or not you pay attention to the food, what you bring to the table, literally what you bring to the table, what you bring to the table personally, culturally, what your aims are. And I think of, if you think of, you know, you couldn't say that the quality of the meal is strictly a function of something which is triggered in you, say, by the food. Rather, the quality of the meal is this whole thing which we carry on over the course of an evening. And similarly, I think with art, what we call aesthetic experience is bound up with talking and thinking and conversation and cultural baggage, as well as education and so on. And as a result, there isn't really anything there that we can ask, well, what are the neural correlates of that? I mean, there are neural correlates of all of it, but the experience isn't in the brain. The experience is something that is happening out there between us with the work of art and each other in the environment.
This is a view I'm sympathetic to. I mean, you talk about something you call Cartesian vertigo, you know, where everything seems brain-centered and everything is a bunch of neural patches or that reductive view. And it doesn't really necessarily work with art to see it because it doesn't come from the neurons. It comes from, as you say, everything around us. And just a few weeks ago, I was at the MoMA in New York, and I was seeing this New York Times called the exhibit of a lifetime, the new Picasso sculpture exhibit. And I realized, you know, I was picking up things that other people were saying. Mm-hmm. And I mean, of course, I was reading you. Mm-hmm. But I'm also was cognizant of the fact that I was seeing Picasso in a different form here, but had seen other Picassos on canvases. And all of that went into my appreciation of the work and what I was experiencing. And you're really saying here, I think, well, you say, for example, art is a research practice. It's a way of investigating the world and ourselves, and I think that's right. I think it has to do with, I'm reminded of a line from Planetarium, a poem of Adrienne Rich, what we see and seeing is changing. It can transform
beautiful.
Us, really.
That's beautiful. Yeah. That's beautiful. I was actually at MoMA last weekend, and I saw the Picasso show, but I spent most of my time looking at the Andy Warhol show. And I don't know if you had a chance to look at it when you were there.
I did.
But
yeah.
there was a room there devoted to his Campbell Soup paintings, all 32 of them in all 32 flavors. And it was interesting. It was the first time I'd seen them. I've seen them reproduced. They're talked about. They're almost a kind of cliche of what contemporary or avant-garde, you know, modernist art is. But looking at that work, I realized that all of this knowledge that in that case I'd brought to it was actually blinding me to it. These were paintings. These were handcrafted, carefully observed. You know, they weren't bits of commercial design. They were really bits of exploration of text and certainly working from a commercial image. But they were such interesting objects. And I spent a long time looking at them and thinking about why he made the choices he made. And at one point I looked around, and I hope this won't sound condescending or hypercritical, but at one point I looked around. I was really there for quite a while. And I realized I hadn't seen anybody else the whole time I was there looking at the work. They all came in, they snapped a picture. They snapped a picture of themselves in front of the picture. And they didn't sort of, from my point of view, they didn't press the on button. They didn't engage. And what was so beautiful about it is that they thought they were seeing it. They said, I heard one mother say to her child, oh, look at these silk screens as she walked on. But they weren't. These were little handmade paintings. And because her knowledge of them was sort of occluded by her knowledge of the poster version of them. And to me, that's what makes art so special. You can go in and not see, but when you try to see, when you ask a question, when you look harder, when you don't let yourself just move to the stage of taking a selfie, you can actually be transformed. You can go from blindness to sight, from seeing to seeing differently, and really make discoveries.
I'm going to quote you here. Art illuminates us to ourselves.
Yeah, I think that's right. Because what's so beautiful about it is it's not just that you undergo a kind of a reorganization that lets you see it. It lets you catch yourself in the act of doing that. That's a gift. I mean, that's something which we can make happen, and which it's so easy not to make happen. And I think art is really challenging us constantly to do that, and to have experiences that bring what is there into focus for us, and bring ourselves, therefore, unveil us to ourselves.
In this way, art's like love and money, isn't it?
No comment.
Well, you kind of indicate that at one point or two in your work. In fact, you did a piece in the New York Times that struck me that I want to bring into this conversation about doorknobs. You were talking about doorknobs, and you were talking also about, Leonardo's depiction of the lady with ermine and that big hand and that painting, which a lot of listeners may not know or recognize, but it's purposeful, you say. I mean, there's a disparity there that requires plain looking and becoming involved and engaged.
Looking, thinking, questioning. I think art gives back what you throw into it. It's like, in that sense, it is like conversation, or it is like. You know, it's not passive.
But don't let me be obscure here. Let's get back to the doorknobs here and how they...
Oh, yeah. So the thing about the doorknob is, let me take one step back. One of the interesting questions is that artists make things. That's one of the most uncontroversial statements one could possibly make about art. Artists write poems, they put together plays, they stage performances, they make paintings, they make installations. And yet, as I mentioned a little while ago, we don't measure the success or failure or even the value of works of art by how effective they are in any sort of straightforward sense. And so the question then is, why are artists so bent on making? And the idea I have, and this is really at the heart of the book, and this is what I broached in that piece in the New York Times that you mentioned, is that artists don't make stuff, I think, because what they make is so darn special. But it's because making is so special for us, because of the way making and also using the tools like doorknobs that we make are so defining for what it is to be a human being. So think about the doorknob. Doorknobs are so easy, so straightforward, so self-evident to us as tools. If you have to stop and think about how to work the doorknob to get through the door, well, then the doorknob isn't doing the job it's supposed to be doing. The doorknob is supposed to, as Heidegger said, and as my colleague at Berkeley, Hubert Dreyfus, is always emphasizing, the doorknob recedes. It's invisible to us when it is integrated with our lives. But what works of art are sort of doorknobs that you are required to stop and look at and wonder. And because you have to stop and look at and wonder about them, all this other stuff, which is normally just in the background and unnoticed, gets suddenly thrust into the foreground. And that's an example to me of the kind of revelation, really, and potentially even reorganization that art offers us.
And philosophically, it requires us, or should require us, to, I'm using, I think, your language here again, reorganize ourselves?
Yeah, because one of the things which is so defining of human being, and this is not a negative thing, this is actually, I think, a sort of a biological imperative, is that we live by habit, the way we look, the way we see, the way we move, the way we talk. One of the examples I look at a lot in the book is breastfeeding. So much of what we do is sort of is automatic and exhibits a kind of habitual structure of organization. And art, when we let it, if we're generous enough or brave enough or if we have the resources to let it, art interrupts all that. And I think that interruption gives us the opportunity to do things differently. Not to be free of habit, not to be free of organization, but to have new ways of organizing ourselves. I can give you a kind of an interesting example. It's a general example, but I think it kind of makes the point. When people, if you go to a party and watch people dancing, you know, they're dancing freely, they're dancing playfully, they're dancing to have a good time, they're dancing with their friends, they're dancing to celebrate, whatever the reasons might be that they're bringing to the table. You can see the ways, if you watch, the way in which the way they're dancing is influenced and shaped by representations that they have of what dancing looks like, which are inherited through choreography. So choreography isn't just more dancing. Choreography is the kind of display of dancing and of the place it has in our lives.
Or they can look idiotic like I do.
Right. Well, I'm not saying we necessarily dance very well, but what's interesting is the way in which an image we have of what dancing is loops down and changes the way we dance. And that's a kind of very subtle and, I think, sort of a paradigmatic example of the way in which the existence of art and the kind of first order activities that make up our lives kind of blend into each other, and the one shapes the other and reorganizes it.
And we're talking to Alvin Noway, professor of philosophy at UC Berkeley and author of Strange Tools, Art and Human Nature. You said you kind of indicated you weren't bashing neuroscience here or neuroaesthetics necessarily, but there's you also say that there's really no plausible conception of human nature or the experiences we have, I mean, beyond art, via neuroscience, that it doesn't give us the answers. And there's certainly been a lot of stock put into the notion that it does give us those answers. So are we talking about something, as you just intimated, maybe more biological here?
Well,
whole biological.
So the thing about neuroscience, again, this is not true of every neuroscience, every neuroscientist or all neuroscience, but the sort of the neuroscience that gets the most attention, which tries to look at human consciousness or human perception, tends to be what I call internalistic. It thinks of experience as something that happens in your head as a result of the bombardment of stimulation on your nervous system. I think of all that bombardment as just an opportunity for us to do things, and I think of the experience as what we do. So I reject a kind of trigger conception. I don't think then we can turn to neuroscience for an adequate conception of experience and then simply apply that to this problem that interests us, namely the problem of the experience of art. In fact, what really my intuition is that it may go the other way around. If we really try to come to grips with art and its place in our lives, that may give us resources to frame a better conception of what experience is, what perception is, what consciousness is, what human nature is, and even one that can help us make a better neuroscience. It's really important. I want to be clear about this. I was clear about this in my last book, Out of Our Heads, which was also a criticism of some neuroscientific approaches to consciousness. And I want to be clear about it here. It's not that I want to say we shouldn't try to think about art and other aspects of our lives in relation to biology, but we need a less internalistic and indeed a less individualistic conception of our biology. And I think actually art requires that we come to grips with that.
And we dropped this word neuroaesthetics. We might want to define it a bit and talk about how it's become prominent and preeminent in many ways.
Yeah, neuroaesthetics is a term that has become quite established. I think it really doesn't mean anything other than the attempt to use the methods and techniques and knowledge of neuroscience to help us understand art and its place in our lives. And what so often happens if you look at studies in so-called neuroaesthetics is that they yield wonderful information, but not information about art. So, for example, there are studies that look at the way in which the human visual system, in particular, say, color vision, is put to work in wonderful and marvelous ways in, say, looking at a colorful painting, such as a Mondrian. And that does show you the way in which we apply our ability to see to a Mondrian, but it doesn't even begin to ask the question, well, what makes a Mondrian more interesting than any other colorful thing you might see when you're walking down the street? Or simply forget about more interesting. Maybe it's not more interesting, but what makes it different? What's the distinctive art in it? And so my thought is that really we shouldn't be asking what art does to us in the sense of what it triggers in our nervous system, even though our engagement with art depends on what goes on in our nervous system. It's much, much better to ask what work does art do? What does it allow us to accomplish and to achieve? And I think, as I said at the outset, I think really the work it does is philosophical. It's in fact, I really want to say that art is a kind of philosophy, or for that matter, philosophy is a kind of art. One of the things I'm going on kind of in a long-winded way, but one of the things I'm really interested in understanding is why is art so important? You know, it's not just pretty pictures. It's not just entertainment. There's people really care about art. They disagree about art, and their disagreements matter. I have a very dear friend who doesn't like Neil Young, and this continues to, you know, to be a problem for us in our friendship. How could he not like Neil Young? But it doesn't just stop there. It's something we talk about, and we feel the need to talk about. So
I like to push my students when I'm teaching literature to say, how do you judge this work? And not only interpret it, but evaluate it, and how do you assess meaning and value and apply that to it? And I use a crude analogy sometimes of we seem to have a system of aesthetics, and some of us know, for example, if we're like we might like ground beef, but we know T-bone's a better cut. You know, so even though we may have a hankering for ground beef, we have this knowledge in our head about something that's maybe being better. But you can get into elitism and snobism and all the rest of those kind of vagaries that come about as a result of this. You actually talk about a Harvard guy named Patrick Kavanaugh, who says painters are neuroscientists. What do you mean by that? You kind of take him on that, I think.
Well, he's sort of interested in the ways in which you can think of paintings insofar as we see them as depicting something. You can see them then as an example is if you don't notice that shadows are rendered unrealistically in paintings, that shows that that the painter's representation of shadows is like ours. But all of that is just presupposing, I think, a pretty, you know, for example, the equation of paintings or pictures and the project of art. But art is not about depiction, although artists make pictures. To me, the more interesting question is what do works of art that are pictures reveal about pictoriality or the place of pictures in our lives or how we see things in pictures.
Our guest again, Alvin Noe, and his new book again is Strange Tools, Art and Human Nature, and be interested to hear what our listeners have to say about this. By the way, Alvin will be appearing at Books Inc. in Berkeley on October 27th, Tuesday, and you are cordially invited to join this conversation. Dealing with some big, big questions here, but maybe the central question is, why is art important? And why is it important to you? We asked that question, in fact, on Facebook, social media to our listeners and got some of the – actually, what we asked was, in three words, describe the power of art for you. Some of the responses, David writes, gives life meaning. Sorrel writes, utility, creativity, inspiring. Saskia says, see things differently. And Madison writes, art documents zeitgeist. Mm-hmm. And we've got another call, listener here who says, love the comments about making. Another thought, all art is about death because it's a way of trying to defy mortality, a way of saying I was here or extending ourselves beyond our bodies, our lives, etc. You may want to weigh in here, and in fact, we invite you to do so. As I said, these are big questions, but really talking about how and what ways art affects you and why is it important? And maybe also, as Alvin Noe was saying earlier, is it a kind of philosophy? Or is philosophy a kind of art? He's a philosopher and he's spending the rest of this hour with us, and you can join us. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. And feel free to join us now. That number for you to call, 866-733-6786. We'd certainly welcome your thoughts and your ideas on this. It's all about consciousness, after all, and so is this program. Email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, and you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with philosopher Alvin Noe on the limitations of understanding art through neuroscience, but also what he takes up in his new book, Strange Tools, which, as I said to him off air, could refer to various cadres of people, placing an original theory of art and its values in our lives and actually discussing not only the ephemeral nature of how we perceive and understand art, but what it does to us and why it affects us and the kind of impact it has. And we were just talking a little bit off microphone about, I brought up the whole business of snobism and elitism, and Alva wanted to insert something here about John Dewey.
Well, John Dewey, in his marvelous book, Art as Experience, thought that the biggest thing that got in the way of our appreciation of art was the objects themselves, which is a kind of crazy, crazy thing. He thought that the works of art on which we try to build a theory of what they are sort of get in the way of our getting a clear understanding of art in our lives, because he says it's not the things, it's the experience. And the experience isn't something you get, Dewey thought, just for the price of admission into the museum. You can buy your ticket and buy your audio guide and walk through with your friends and never see the art, never engage it. And Dewey thought that the whole idea that just because it's in the museum makes it good was also something sort of really connected to this idea of snobism and elitism, the museum conception of art on a pedestal, and you somehow just need to educate yourself to it. He wanted us to look, and in looking, open ourselves up to actually trying to see.
Let's bring our callers in. We go first to you, Zachary. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I read Alvin Noe's previous book and was blown away by it. And I actually mentioned it in a talk that I gave last night. So the thing that kind of struck me the hardest about it was I got this message from it. He's saying something like, "Mind is." Impossible to disentangle from the world, right? The mind that we have only is the way it is because the world is the way it is, which is something that that Buddhists, in particular Zen Buddhists, have been saying for well over 1,000 years. And so I've always wondered secretly whether Alvin Noe was a Zen Buddhist. So that's my question. And then the second question, I also wanted to do a forward summation of art. So the forward summation of art is encounter with the inconceivable. But I guess I'd also like an answer to the question, but I'll take it off the line. So.
Okay, and we thank you for the call, Zachary. He wants to know if you're a Buddhist, a Zen Buddhist.
Zachary, thanks a lot. I just going to the last point first, the encounter with the inconceivable. I sometimes like to think of it as trying to see the invisible, which is sort of a similar idea. Seeing what you can't see, which is really just another way of saying seeing with a kind of understanding that goes beyond the merely sensory. I'm not a Zen Buddhist, but some of my best friends are.
Let me bring another caller on right away here, and we go to Menlo Park and welcome Charlie. Good morning.
Hi. Yeah, you're so on point. I'm actually in the process. I have a machine shop, and I'm making custom hardware handles, door handles, for some of the local rich people. And that whole having it be invisible, again, that really speaks to as somebody enters a space and it allows them to capture the whole architectural design, that kind of thing. And, as people are defining art, I've often held that it's where expression creates impression. But I just love what you're saying here. And another great hour. Thanks.
Charlie, you got to tell us, what kind of custom doorknobs are we talking about here?
Well,
play to my imagination.
A lot of brass, levers, and knobs on top of Broadway there. I've actually got three places on the top of where Broadway runs into the Presidio, their Billionaire's Row, that I'm making various escutcheons and handles that somehow incorporate to the design of the architect. So, like that. You often finished with a oil rub bronze so that as you work them, the luster becomes more pretty. So, like that.
Well, good luck with that. You're an artist in your own right, and thank you for the call. Although, even is our next caller, and even wants to know, Evan, about the difference between art and craft. Evan, go ahead.
Yes, hello. I grew up in the 70s. My sister studied fine arts at Otis in L.A., and there were artists like, let's say, Whalen, who does the whales, as well as Thomas Kincaid, the artist of light. And her opinion is that when they created something new for the first time, let's say the beautiful whale on the wall down in Laguna Beach, and that was art because it was new. It doesn't have to be good, but it wasn't new. And then once it fell into a form where he sort of just repeated it without necessarily creating something new, it fell into a craft. I was wondering what your guests thought of that distinction.
Thanks very much for that question, which is a big one. And it's one that I have a pretty straightforward view about, although I'm always a little bit worried because sometimes the distinction between art and craft is another way of talking about sort of high art and mere craft, as if it's pejorative to just be craft. But for me, crafts are bound up with functions. People apply their crafts to make things that do this or do that, whether it's a doorknob or anything else. And for me, what's decisive about the impulse to make art is that instead of taking a function for granted, it calls into question what function is or what it might be or why we care about function or what the different functions that we care about are. So it always breaks the rule book that craft uses. Now, one way it gets more complicated is that in actual practice, in real life, and this is related to what I was talking about before with choreography and looping, a lot of craftspeople are also artists, and artists are also craftspeople. In other words, just as a sculpture could make a really good paperweight, one and the same thing could be a paperweight and a sculpture. It can be a paperweight and a work of art. So works of craft and works of art can sort of embody the same thing. The crucial point is that what makes it a good work of art or a valuable work of art is not how good a paperweight it is.
Well, you mentioned high art, and now you're talking about good art and so forth. There are these distinctions, and they have endured between high art and popular art or junk art or even highbrow, middlebrow, lowbrow. They seem to stick in people's minds, and it gets into, well, snobism again, elitism, yeah.
I think this goes back to a line of thought that you were, you know, that you passed over earlier in the conversation. I think that the question with art is not whether you like it, but why do you like it? And that you have a response, say a pro or even a negative response to something, is really just the occasion for the further conversation, the further engagement, where I think a lot of the benefit, the work, the value, the pleasures of art really lie in the kind of the getting it, the thinking about it. And I think it's crazy to think that some class of art is sort of the sole proprietor of that. I think that what we call popular art, it can be just as much the site or location for that kind of exciting growth and transformation as, you know, the stuff that gets called high art and put in museums.
We have Sherry Turkle scheduled to be on with us on Monday, and she's done a new book about conversation and how the digital world is moving us more and more away from real conversation. There's something we call the art of conversation, and something obviously I try to be mindful of, but there's also a craft to it too. I mean, you know, I've been at this a number of years to recognize that there's craft. You have to be crafty sometimes in craft too, but there's also an art to it.
It's actually, if I could make a comment about conversation, because the listeners, they think of us sitting here having a conversation, but I have to hold my body in a certain posture so that I speak correctly into the microphone. And I have to, you know, we're in a certain kind of, there's a certain infrastructure surrounding us, which changes the quality of our conversation. It literally changes, because normally when two people talk, they physically coordinate each other. They adopt the same posture. They look around in the same way at the same things. They get into a whole, almost like they dance together. Talking is a kind of dancing. And what we're doing now is this, we've interrupted all of those normal habits of conversation, and we're really trying very thoughtfully to choose our words and stay on point and keep track of time. And there's a lot of craft there, and there could certainly be art there too.
Let me read some listener comments I suppose we could describe this as pushback. This is David, who says, perhaps your guest's thoughts on art are complex and don't lend themselves to short explanations, but I can't help but think that he's overthinking some of this. Good art can make you think, can evoke emotion, or just be eye candy.
Well, eye candy, I don't think so. But if he thinks it's obvious that art provokes thought, then I guess we're in agreement.
Doug writes, I say the mother who hurried past the Warhol was right. It's just a photorealistic painting of a soup can, and the prof is making up and imagining many things about modern art that just aren't there to make himself and the field seem more important. The lucrative modern art empire has no clothes.
No comment.
You don't have to comment, no.
But I take the point. And certainly, by the way, when I talk about what makes art valuable, I'm not talking about, you know, what justifies the prices that these works of art get. I don't think anything can conceivably justify the madness of the art economy and what's happened there. And interestingly, Warhol, probably himself better than anybody else, understood that towards the end of his life. I'm not a Warhol expert, but a friend of mine is writing a biography of him, Blake Gopnik. And Blake was telling me that towards the end of his life, he really did realize that he was going to be making art out of art business. because it was no longer about the work. It was no longer about its qualities as a handmade object. It was made in a factory, and it was made precisely to play with the idea of what is it to make something which we call a valuable work of art. That's just a wonderful example of the kind of irony, the kind of wit that is at home in art.
I want to go to more calls, but let me just read a few more emails and web comments. Clifford writes, "My Down syndrome son's art is an expression from his interior. It's an arresting alternative vision of reality. It's beautiful compositions and colors. It's wonder, presence and light in the midst of the surrounding backdrop of the sacred darkness." And Pete writes, actually a quote of Brock, "Whatever is valuable in painting is precisely what one is incapable of talking about." Let me just go to another social media representative. Well, we asked the question before to complete the thought. "Art is my blank." Peter says, "My lifeline." Teresa says, "Lifesaver." Sonia writes, "My freedom. When I create, I'm centered and everything else noisy in my world doesn't exist. My focus is in the moment and I find my own voice." These are people who are talking about creation more than they are appreciation. But Guy writes, "It's my outlet, my craft, and brings me peace. I never miss an opportunity to see other people's art, whether it's at the Louvre, the Hermitage, or at a state park in the California hills where the Indians once lived. Art is my life."
If I could just make a comment on this idea about art and, you know, what's valuable in it is what we can't talk about. That reminds me of a quote from the artist Robert Irwin, "Seeing is forgetting the name of the thing that you see." And Lawrence Wechsler, who wrote a book on and with Robert Irwin, used that as the title for his book. It's a lovely book. But I'm actually strongly against that idea. I think that there is a response, there is a feeling, and that response and that feeling may not be verbal. But the impulse to verbalize I can illustrate what I'm trying to say like this. People always say that if you have to explain a joke to somebody, then they haven't gotten it. They've missed the point. And obviously that's true. But it's also true that there always is something to get. And there always is something that can be explained. It's no substitute for getting the joke. But you can't really deny that there isn't something to talk about. And I think exactly that's true with art. Art, like jokes, happens in a communicative context between real people. And sometimes you get it and sometimes you don't. And there's a lot to talk about.
Let me go to more calls. We'll go next to San Rafael and welcome Todd. You're on Forum.
Hello, Michael. Hi. Thank you so much. I really appreciate this this whole topic. And I want to thank your guest as well. And I just want to, there's my mind's racing with all of the different ideas, and being an artist myself, I think it's really important, you know, obviously for myself to be creative and to create works of art, but I also firmly believe it is a form of philosophy, and I think a big part of doing art is the intent, and so, you know, like a musician who just plays for himself, you know, isn't expected to sell tickets, but somebody who wants to, you know, perform and expect to sell tickets has to elevate their art or their craft to a level that somebody would appreciate it in a different form. So with that said, I have so many different ideas that I would like to get across, but a couple of them are reiterating that, you know, going into art with a preconceived idea. Eve Klein was a good example. And, his paintings I always thought were just blue paintings, but when I stood in front of one for the first time, I was absolutely blown away. And for people passing up art in a museum, I was in the Tate Museum, and I was in front of a Dali, and it was blowing my mind, and people would just, you know, not even take a look at it as they walked by, and I couldn't understand that. So with all those other ideas, I'll leave you with a quote that Hermann Hesse said about art. And it's like the starry firmament, and it reminds us that there's order amid the chaos. So.
Todd, good to hear from you. Thank you for that. Actually, we go back to Aristotle, right? Art is making order out of chaos. Let's bring some more order to the program with more calls, or maybe more chaos. I don't know. Dale, you're on. Hi.
Thanks. Michael, thank you for having this particular program. It really touches my soul. I'm an artist, sculptor, photographer. My latest work was I worked on the Burning Man for 14 years. I actually built the icon. I started out just as one of the grunts and eventually became the senior builder of the man. Last year I built it was 2004. But I was the senior builder at one time, and we're talking about the man itself, nothing else to do with Burning Man except enjoy. But anyway, when I was a student at what then was known as CCAC, now CCA, California College of the Arts, I vowed never to be a starving artist nor make pot boilers, using a term from authors. So I decided to become a firefighter because, being noble work, steady work, and would give me time to do my artwork as well. I'd much rather run into burning buildings than put my soul on the wall for people to criticize or whatnot. But anyway,
your life's been about fire in many ways.
Pardon me?
I say with Burning Man and firefighting, your life's been about fire.
Yeah, it's interesting contrast, isn't it? So I've had more artwork stolen than I've actually sold. At CCAC, we had a student show. My piece, a serigraph, a silkscreen, was the only piece out of the whole show that was stolen. I built a 3-foot tall hookah out of from found materials. I won't go into what the materials were, but anyway, a friend dedicated a whole showcase window in his shop to it, and somebody smashed the plate glass one night and stole it. And I've had numerous small sculptures and paintings stolen and what. So it's a backhanded compliment, I guess. But I truly understand and experience what it's like to be an artist and put your soul online and reveal your most intimate self, and then have people either not understand it, which doesn't bother me too much, but to steal it or deride it or whatever was just more than I wanted to deal with.
Well, it's good of you to express that, and I appreciate you expressing it so genuinely. And Alva had something you wanted to say.
Yeah, I just wanted to jump in and make two comments. The first is just sort of an aside. It's interesting that the California College of Arts and Crafts changed its name to the California College of the Arts. That goes to this question that was raised by an earlier caller about art versus craft. But I also wanted to say that, as a writer and as a philosopher, I know all about being harshly criticized, and it can be very painful. But there's another notion of criticism, which is not sort of the criticism of the attack, but the criticism of the sort of attentive, thoughtful effort to look and describe and articulate and respond and engage and criticize in the context of that generosity. And in my view, that kind of more generous criticism is really the lifeblood of art. It's the oxygen in which art happens.
Yeah, I get a lot of criticism, and some of it seems filled with animus and malice, frankly, but some of it is very constructive and useful, mm-hmm. and has, helped me in this craft or whatever you want to call it. I like to think of it as an art. Helena writes, loving this segment on art. My three words to describe it, no consensus exists.
I agree with that.
Here's Bill, who says, I believe it was the 19th century art critic John Ruskin who said that art is essentially useless. A plain chair works just as well as an elaborately carved one. I have never found an exception to Ruskin's observation.
I agree with that, too.
And Brian tweets, art is about a deeper communication than language and mathematics could ever describe of the human experience. Chris writes, I have an artist friend who is a jeweler that engraves art on the side of the bracelet or ring that only touches the skin so that the art cannot be seen but can be revealed. I simply saw some similarities there in what the guest was talking about and wanted to comment. And here's Ray with three words, continuous self-exploration. And here's another caller, and it's Richard from Berkeley. Richard, welcome.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call. And I had a question for Professor Noe. It has to do with a quote by Andre Malraux, and I came across this during my research and teaching. And the quote is this, art exists for its role of permitting men to escape their human condition, not by fleeing it, but by possessing it. All art is a means of taking hold of human destiny. And this has to do with art as escapism, as we think of entertainment, as a distraction, versus art as a utility to actually, as Malraux says, take hold of human destiny. And I wanted to know what Professor Noe might think of that.
Thanks a lot. That's a magnificent thought that's articulated by Malraux. The first part, that art is what was it? Escaping the human condition, or
right? So once again, art exists for its role of permitting man to escape the human condition, not good. By fleeing it, but by possessing it.
Yeah. Thanks. The thing I don't like. I'm thinking about this now. The thing that bothers me about that is there's a sort of romantic, heroic part of it.
Fits Malraux.
Yeah, it fits Malraux. As if there's, it's a kind of really, as if you can take what you are and simply reject it using art or any other means. And for me, it's a much more organic process, you know, and here I'm really guided by the image of philosophy. Philosophers don't think about a problem and possess it so that once and for all it's settled for the ages or even for themselves. Philosophy is an engagement with puzzlement, a puzzlement which is always generating more questions and always, you know, folding back on itself with more curiosity and more puzzlement. And the benefits of philosophy don't come from settling into the answer, but from all that work you do engaging with the questions. And I think something very similar is true about art. We don't escape our condition, but we do come to understand it better, and we do come to have, if you like, our condition is altered. That's what I would say. Art alters our condition.
Let me thank the caller. And here's an email that may be surprising to hear. John writes, art is egoistic, snarky, navel-gazing. People like to think their random musings are productive. Art is consumptive, not productive. It is getting away with not having to do real productive work. Another nation heard from there. Let's just leave it, I guess. Courtney writes, when I was in art school, my fellow students and I agreed that painters, we were just philosophers who needed visual aids. I've always held that art is an investigation. I personally like to investigate dimensions of the human experience, for instance. Would you talk more about the link you feel that there is between the process of thinking, philosophy, and the making or perhaps manifestation of that thought?
Thank you. That's an excellent challenge to talk more about that. You know, it's so interesting because I talk to a lot of artists, and I even collaborate with artists, and I find that artists in general are very open to this idea that what they're doing is philosophical. It's the philosophers who balk at the suggestion that what they're doing is artistic, because I think so many philosophers are actually sort of committed to the definitive defense of their particular answer. But what interests me is the fact that both art and philosophy are all process and no result. If you measure the value of a work by Kant by its bottom line, well, there is no bottom line, or certainly not one which is sort of you can put in the archives as a settled finding. Kant said space and time are forms of intuition. Was he right? Was he wrong? Well, those words don't have any meaning until we work with Kant to give them meaning. And so for me, Kant's book, and I'm just using Kant now as an example, the great Immanuel Kant, 18th century philosopher, his book is like a score that each of us can use to do our own thought process, our own thinking process, and our own discoveries. And I think that's very manifestly the case with Plato, whose books are actually presented as dialogues, as conversations that we enliven through the participation in them. And I think the same is true with art. It's not there statically in the result. It's in the thoughts and responses that only then bring it to life.
As long as you mention Kant, I can't help thinking about something that I was always intrigued by, and I can't remember where he said it, but he wrote about how artists create a world. They create a world, and the world exists, and the world has its own life to it, and always had a particular kind of meaning for me, a non-philosopher, and I think it pertains. I got an email here from Owen, who sent this email from all the way from Berlin across the pond, and it says, great conversation. I'd like to advocate in favor for people to, as you put it, educate themselves, rise to the level of the museum. I'm a visual artist and went through this process myself. I find the most rewarding way to look at art is to challenge one's own ideas, and the museum presents a wonderful opportunity for this.
Oh, yeah. I didn't mean in any way to sort of take away from the value or importance of the museum. But just because it's hanging there doesn't mean it's going to do any work for you. You've got to do the work, too.
And well, we got a little bit of time left. In fact, a listener wanted to know if it matters where you see the art. I mean, at home, at the Guggenheim. What do you think?
It's interesting.
Or online.
It's interesting. I mean, in a very practical sense, it matters. It's a little bit like, you know, people go to sort of religious places like churches to pray, but you don't have to pray in a church. You can pray anywhere, and spirituality is not confined to an institution. I think art can happen anywhere, anytime, any place. Just as philosophy happens everywhere in our lives, or can. It doesn't have to. It can happen.
We'll leave it there. Alvin Noy, good to have you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a real treat.
Alvin Noy is professor of philosophy at UC Berkeley. His book is Strange Tools, Art and Human Nature, and he'll be at Books, Inc. in Berkeley Tuesday, October 27th. He's also, by the way, a member of the Institute for Cognitive and Brain Sciences, as well as the Institute for New Media. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. You can continue this discussion online by going to kqed.org/forum. Forum is produced by Irene Gucci, Tina Lauberg, Susan Britton, and Suki Lewis. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our interns are LaToya Tools and Jeremy Siegel. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, we thank you for being a part of this morning's program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.